Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about some pests that you might be seeing in your fields. Our spotlight will take a look at the growth of the Indiana 4-H program. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about the history of integrated pest management. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Starting today, it's back.
What's back?
Canadian wildfire smoke. We're supposed to get some.
It's coming back?
Yep. After a short hiatus, it is returning, supposedly. They've got some Canadian wildfires. I think it was in Alberta, Manitoba area.
2023 was the worst year, right? It was 2 years ago?
Yep. Yeah, the drought year was, or when we started dry,
yeah.
It was... That year was also very smoky.
Who's all getting it? Is it like whole Midwest or like even remember that year, like New York City
yeah,
had it real
yeah,
bad
like
and just
almost like smog.
Yeah,
because it's further west. I think in the way the system is moving, it looked like it was like UP, us, maybe parts of Michigan. And that was just the forecast I saw for like today. I don't know if it'll keep pushing east then or. But yeah, it's Manitoba, Ontario, and Saskatchewan are the current locations of 160 wildfires active.
It's crazy to me how they can forecast where this smoke is going. Like, that is pretty cool. Yeah, this is showing, like, quite a bit in the Midwest. Gonna get it.
Yeah, like, it's the start of it today, so the first prediction kind of just... saw it pushing, or that I saw was pushing at us. Now, yeah, looking at this other map here, looks like it'll get down as far as Chicago, into like Iowa too, potentially.
Well, good thing our corn is nice and green and great looking that it doesn't need a lot of sunshine right now.
What? No, we don't need smoke right
now. No, I don't.
No. At all.
I will say it does seem like it's greened up a little since Monday.
It's very slow, but it's gotten a lot better.
Yeah,
especially after Wednesday, I feel like it.
Yeah,
it was better, but it's God. It feels like a Groundhog Day type of week where we just lost. Like the corn wasn't getting any GDU, especially in the soil. But we had a very cold rain and then a cold week.
Yeah,
and the corn just sat there and did nothing.
Yeah,
for 6 days. And you wouldn't think, like, 6 days, you just, okay, then it just act like it wasn't planted 6 days ago. This is easy, but it does not. There's some anxiety that comes with that and some frustration of, like, is this still going to come up? What's it doing? Like, yeah. I would say the root it's putting on seems quite good.
Yeah.
So that's a good sign. And I had an older, a farmer told me about an older agronomist that told him that, don't worry about it. It's just putting, you know, when this happened years ago, it's just putting down root. It's okay. Like it's just, and I equate it to like a rubber band just being kind of pulled back and just ready to shoot.
Like, slingshot out.
So it's in the near future here, get 80s and 90s. So yeah, should be fine.
I'm less worried about corn. Beans are more my,
yeah, you're
my
right,
bag
man.
Right now.
You're right about that.
Cause I've got beans that have been in for almost 3 weeks and it's not like super.
I did not see that, Todd. 90 on Monday.
90, yes.
Yeah, 90 on Monday.
I mean, wow. Not everywhere is hitting 90, like some places, but 86, which for
even today is perfect. In the 70s. And then
70s the next 2 days.
Yep,
up the weekend. Almost 80 on Sunday.
So right. To me, it was like pump the brakes on being worried, just calm down and be worried next week if you don't see it. By, you know, after 3 days of warm. That
breakfast on the farm this week or next week?
Nope.
Next week.
The
Outagamie
one is the 8th.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, they have shocking thunderstorms. I mean, it's a week out, but yeah. So I think Brown County's is this week.
Brown County's is the 1st, which is Sunday, yep.
Yeah, they got 80s pretty much early week is hot, and then it gets cooler, but only in the mid-70s, so it'll be a good week.
Yeah, midweek, there's supposed to be a chance of rain again. Oh, nope, I didn't want to do that. I was trying to see what other breakfasts on the farms are this week.
There's Lemonesses down at...
In Dodge County, yep.
Yeah.
I think O'Connell's is too, up at Huckwitz's.
So yeah, this is the best when June Dairy Month starts. We're going to...
Granton Dairy Breakfast, Brown County at Wayside Dairy, Dodge County, which is at Plum Creek Dairy, Lemonesses, Stratford FFA Alumni Dairy Breakfast in Stratford, Wisconsin, Abbotsford FFA Alumni Dairy Breakfast at DeJong Dairy in Dorchester. Oh yeah, those are the ones going on this weekend. You also have Dairy Fest at Marshfield starting today and going through tomorrow. So nothing like a good dairy breakfast for the month of June, as June Dairy Month starts on Sunday. So good kickoff to have Brown County's Breakfast on the Farm, and it's not supposed to rain a bunch, so they hopefully won't have to bus people or anything. Was that last year?
Yeah.
Yeah, last year they couldn't park anywhere.
Yeah, parking is always the toughest for Breakfast on the Farms, isn't it? Where,
well, yeah, you never know.
A little wet, and then...
You never know what kind of crowd you're going to get.
Like, right.
How big. So you plan for what your probably average... I don't know if they use the five-year average or like last couple-year average, how they really do that. But it's like, you know, you plan for a little bit over that probably, and then sometimes they end up running out of food. Sometimes you have way too much left over. It's a hard gig.
I know for a while they're pushing, especially in Outagamie County, to pre-buy tickets. And, like, you could do it through, like, the one you would, what's that, a money app on your phone?
Venmo.
Venmo, thank you. You'd Venmo money and, like, you'd get the tickets. And I think that makes a lot of sense. And they know, and there was, like, certain grocery stores you could buy them at. And then they'd have an idea of the number. But they haven't been pushing that as hard, so I'm not sure if it really didn't.
I think even with that, though, sometimes
it's... Right, because you're still going to get... Yeah. X amount to just show up or not.
Yeah, so we only got like 500 people that pre-bought tickets, and then you get 5,000 to show up. So, yeah, it's a hard game to play. It really is planning any event, planning where you don't have like a specific group that you can, you know, get a gauge from. It's hard. This is the weather, like this weekend looks beautiful for it. So the weather...
Right, so you're going to get...
You'll hopefully get, a better crowd than you would otherwise, but yeah.
I have seen lately, like, not that... I just remember when the weather was poor, you'd get almost, like, nobody. And now I've heard some of the... Like, last year, I know Winnebago County's, the weather was poor, and they still had a good crowd. You know, like...
Yeah.
It still seems like people come out a little bit even if the weather ain't perfect.
Like, Outagamie's last year, I remember it being cold because I was there... Like, though it wasn't like cold, like last week cold, but there was a breeze, and it's hard when you're, you know, getting your eggs out of the roaster by the time you get your milk and go sit down, your eggs are cold because it's
probably 55, 60,
right,
and cloudy. So it wasn't probably bad, but it just wasn't nice.
And it didn't rain that day, which was nice. Like, the sun did come out, and it turned out to be a really nice day in general, but yeah, you just never know what to expect.
What's one breakfast that you never been to that you want, like you think would be?
I've never been to Kiwani's where they have the pizza.
Pizza, I agree. Like, that's one that's up there.
Like all the rest of them, when I've looked at what they've got, like I've been to Brown County's.
Standard, right?
Yeah, I haven't been to Wapaka's, but I think their thing's the cinnamon roll, right? They have, or who's?
Well, Outagamie's.
Outagamie's got the cinnamon roll too.
Wapaka's is interesting because it's at the
fairgrounds, right?
So like that would be interesting to see too, like what's obviously park, like it's a little bit more standardized where how everything flows. So I'm
probably
guessing
easy for the Wapaka County.
Oh, it's got to be way better to set up.
Like, and parking's probably not an issue.
Right.
You don't have to worry about a farm. Forward.
No tents. No.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know if just a bunch of people bring in cattle into the dairy barn, kind of a thing.
Probably. That, but
Winnebago County this year is Grilled Cheese Day. And that's at Silver Shay Holsteins and Amro.
I think they've done Silver that before, right?
I don't know, but that one I feel like's one. I've been to Winnebago counties before, and I don't remember. I just remember it being good.
Or no, I'm thinking of it was Calumet does Sunday on the farm.
Sunday on the farm, yes, yeah. They do that.
That yeah, I knew there was something that was a little bit different.
I wonder who's got the record for like the most in one season.
The most
dairy breakfast that they've attended.
Oh, I'm sure it's Mike Austin.
That's who I thought. Yep. Mike yeah. Austin. Yep,
he sure. would go like
he would go to multiple like
three,
in
four,
a day,
right? Yeah. If there was a day, two yeah. a day or yeah. three a day, he'd find a way.
Yeah, I wonder if Mike still goes to dairy breakfast or not. Just to,
I mean, yeah, he's not obligated probably as much.
Maybe
as
he just
before,
like but... hates him now. Like I don't even want to eat at a farm.
Well, anymore. the last time I was at Winnebago was. Breakfast on the Farm was with you.
Yep.
And he was there, and they got him to, like, MC, like, the
You're
music
right. he had
thing
to do
in
different.
The,
yep.
where we were. So, yeah, that was kind of fun. But, yeah, that is a good June Dairy Month challenge, try to get it to as many as
you can.
When you look at the schedule of them, too, like, Shano does, there's this, like, the brunch on the farm. You know, some of these ones that are a little, set up a little different. Like, if you go right at 8... to one that starts or nine, whatever it is, eat your breakfast, leave, and drive to the next one. Like,
I feel like at some point you get caught in, like, if you, so your goal is to eat, right? Like, to get in line and eat at each one of these or just be there?
No, to eat. You got to eat.
I feel like if you,
that'd
you
be a lot of that, food. Man, it's already like, a lot of food at one.
You could get to one at 8, but what if you got to the next one at like 10? You'd be in line.
Yeah, part of the challenge would be
yeah,
you have to eat.
Yeah, watch where you hit.
You would have to eat at him, I agree.
But then you'd go to, like, the third one at 11:30 or whatever, and maybe it's done at noon and the food's gone, too. So I think that might be harder than it sounds to actually eat at every one of them.
You'd have to make arrangements for the one you're going to hit, like, at the busiest time to get somebody to, like, DoorDash you. Like, just like, yeah, all right, go get in line, get some food, and I will meet you in the parking lot.
I feel like this is a YouTube channel, like
the
all these people
JDM
that,
challenge.
Yeah,
JDM
like all these people that do. Like my kids watch some dude that has a penny and he tries to get across this country with a penny to meet Mr. Beast to give him the penny, and then he's got to like
some of that stuff. Just
I've already fallen asleep.
Yeah, but all these kids like love it.
Oh my god, it's like thing. He somehow gets a case of water and then he sells water.
So he has to use the penny to.
Yeah, to like get other things to make more money to be able to like buy a cab or buy an airfare or buy a bus fare to get from like California to I think he's in North Carolina.
I think so, yeah.
But then, Mr. Beast.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not the same penny. Like he's not delivering that.
I thought he was like
just he has to make sure he gets to him with a penny.
With
a penny. Yep.
Yeah. I
so I feel like that could be like this day and age of the YouTube and all this, like you could do that. And
I don't get Mr. Beast's popularity. I really don't. Like my son wanted to watch the Beast Games.
Yeah. Now he's into all like,
and it's like, this guy is a terrible person. Like he's just teasing all these people with money.
Right.
I will give you $10,000 to put your hand on this car for as
like
long
he,
as you
he's
can.
Not encouraging violence, but he's stopping short basically. Like
it's a giant like social experiment. That's for sure.
He's just screwing people's heads.
Yeah. And like you say, some of the times, yeah, like that you'd think like this person would win. Then he's like this whole, almost like a Hunger Games game master scenario, but without the violence. You're right, man. Like it's
like
definitely
either one of you sacrifices yourself or you're all out. Right. And it's like, wait, what?
That took a turn I didn't expect or wanted to take there, but
no, that is like I only watched one episode, and after that, I was just like, I'd never want to watch any of this again. Is it like? It's the worst kind of reality TV because they're all like telling their sob story about how, you know, they need this money for whatever. And then it's like, yep. And then they just by random chance get, it's like playing the lottery, but your odds are a lot worse because you have to make decisions and you sometimes it's completely out of your control.
Right.
Like, at least with the lottery, you choose to buy the ticket. And then you're just waiting to see if your number gets pulled. But, yeah. That's my soapbox.
Yeah.
I didn't know
we opened up a box with Mr. Beast. Yeah. Matt.
Sorry, Matt.
That's my hot take for the day. Mr. Beast is garbage. And my family is annoyed because I'm not shy about expressing that. I don't hate him. I just don't think he's a good person.
How do you feel about Dude Perfect? No, I'm just saying any other.
Even that's kind of getting played out. So many different people do bottle flips and all that other stuff.
Well, and it's turned into these, like, to me, like this sort of dude bro culture.
Who are the guys that dropped the Hulk hand? That's not Dude Perfect. But it's in the same vein.
Yeah.
They, like, have a tower and they drop. As I've seen the videos, they drop like a Hulk hand.
Stuff. They're Australian guys.
Yeah.
They're actually a little bit more educational. So, like, there's this weird line, too, of
right.
that stuff.
No,
like,
I would say Mark Roberg
guy is an actual...
He's the best.
Yes.
Yeah, he was on Kimmel and different stuff. Yeah.
And then you get
science
kind of...
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And then you get to just the total...
It's like, if Bill Nye had a social media account.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I don't like Dude Perfect because of the Tyler that does the raging and the screaming. Like, I just don't think that's a good thing for young kids to watch. Like, just screaming and breaking things. Like, you have a 6-year-old that's watching this. It's just not.
Oh, I guess I didn't don't pay enough attention to Dude Perfect. I didn't realize there was a raging, screaming guy.
Oh, yeah. He's just always... He always wins the challenges, and then he screams at everybody, and then he's, like, they do these, like... They're not superlatives, but it's like stereotypes. They do all these different stereotypes. And it's always he does some pick a stereotype and then rage monster. Like,
okay,
dude at baseball game. And then you got like the dad and the coach and the overbearing dad and the overbearing mom. And then you got the dude at the baseball game that's a rage monster that's screaming at everybody and chucking stuff. It's like, it just isn't. Like, do better, you know? Like, come on.
I'm glad I'm not the only one with the soapbox today, Todd.
Yep. I'll say,
what YouTuber do you hate?
No, how ridiculous are the guys that are like Dude Perfect, but better, like, little better for kids to be watching? But no, I don't like any YouTuber, I guess. Actually, my soapbox would be today's kids saying, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And, like, their answer is a YouTuber. Like, when we were kids, it was like football player or. You know, an actor or whatever. No, right.
It's equally ridiculous.
I want to be a YouTuber, and it is equally ridiculous. You're right. But part of me with that's like, well, yeah, just, okay, here's your phone. Go do that. Then, yeah.
Yeah. And hope people care. Like you enough or hate you enough.
Right.
That's the thing with YouTube, too, is like hate sometimes is almost like as good of a way of getting famous, like Jake Paul and all those guys that are also garbage, but nobody likes them, but yet they're still in the media all the time.
It is crazy the crap they come, like Dude Perfect, the crap they come up with, like the stunts and the bottle, like what it is cool, like the premise where they started was all these trick shots, which is cool, but it's just, to me, it's moved into this, like, now
you're
unproductive.
It plays out after so long.
Yeah.
Checking a basketball from way far and doing 100 takes, but just showing, so yeah. You know who I do hate, man?
Who do you hate?
Is Black Cutworm.
Oh, I do. I do also.
I really hate.
I feel like every year, like, that's, like, in our little Tilth group chat, that brings out the most veracity amongst everyone, whoever finds the first black cutworm.
Yeah.
You did, Matt.
I did. I was
won.
First. That used to be a YouTube thing, remember? People who put first. And they were the first one to watch a video.
I don't.
That was also stupid. But anyway, let's get into our topic for today. So pests, bug monitoring in general, we call it integrated pest management, or IPM, but it's an important part of our scouting program throughout the year, and every year we don't know exactly what we're going to see, but this year, yeah, like Bill said, we saw some black cutworm already. I know they got the weevil alert. I think that was like 2 weeks ago already. Time to start looking for weevils, and now that first crop has been coming off. it's a good time to be looking at that. But so in general, bug monitoring is something that can be done in a number of ways. One of the ways we do it in our scouting is, like I said, sweeping alfalfa. That's usually a good way to find lots of different bugs. Sometimes bugs that will surprise you.
Most of the time, bugs that surprise you. What's the most surprising bug you found in your net?
A frog.
Frog?
Yeah.
Like how big?
It was a bug. Like a quarter-sized frog.
Is it over threshold?
Yes.
Frog.
One per net.
It's one of the plagues. That's the side. I think we find a lot of the plagues in the, there's locust. There's frogs.
I did not find any mice or rats in my.
No, okay.
That would be bees are bad enough when you get bees, a bee in the net.
Yes, bees aren't my favorite.
But if I found, a rat or a mouse, I think you'd notice right away because the net would be significantly
heavier.
Yeah, you would
totally heavier. You're talking about plagues, so.
No, but yeah, if you found a rat, I think you'd just probably quit. Yeah, it's like, nope.
But yeah, that's a good way to see a lot of different bugs. Pea aphids are a big one in alfalfa. And those are tricky because guys tend to get freaked out by the amount of pea aphids that are on the cutter bar when they go.
Every year I get the phone call. Can you come look at the haybine or the mower because there's just so many bugs here.
It's crawling.
It's like, yeah, because you're cutting every stalk, every plant. Like,
yeah, it's shake. It's literally a giant sweep net. You're shaking onto that cutter
bar. But it's not just the little sweeps we do. It's like every acre of that, every square inch of that field is going through that.
Right. If it was always debatable whether it's actually giving you protein in there or not.
If there's enough mashed up in the...
Right. And I've always wanted to do that, and it wouldn't be that hard of a... Like, I just got to find a field with a ton of pea aphids and then shake them off some, send them
to the lab.
Into the lab, and then... So, yes.
Send them to a nutrition lab?
Yeah, and see.
Have you ever specifically sprayed an alfalfa field for PA?
New seeding a couple times where they were bad, but in general, no. And like you say, if they're on the cutter bar like that, you're cutting it.
Right.
So you did it. You they're gone now. They don't survive to the next cutting very easily. So
no. Except for the ones on the cutter bar that then hop off in the next field.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, that was I've also had farmers instead of spraying, why don't you make a giant sweep net thing that you put on the
vacuum them up
like a vacuum type, yes, and then basically
bug sucker
2000. Right, you put them at the edge and I'm like, what are you gonna do with the bugs? And I don't know, burn them or something at the edge or
throw them in the manure pit.
Yeah, right, there you go. I didn't think a manure pit would be good.
But you have to account for the nutrients and all the pH aphids.
Yeah,
yes, you do.
Todd, is that how are you forgoing the sweep net and you're just going to take one of those handheld Dyson vacuums and you're going to
just
go through a field?
Yep. We should make the threshold on that, yeah. Or you've seen the guy who pulls out, I don't need to carry it on a sweep net, and then they pull off their baseball cap and do the old whoop, whoop. And
look at that. Look at all those bugs. Yeah.
It's like, is that the standard, net size of, diameter? So no, please use the correct sweep net and the correct method and...
How many times a year do you get teased that you're just out?
Oh, like
catching butterflies.
Butterflies.
Yeah. I mean, you do. I often wonder what people, when you're near a road and you're doing it, what they think as they're driving by. Like, what is that guy doing?
So she knows I'm more of a grown man. It's a little different than when, when you're first out of college, even, or in your 30s, 20s, it's not as different. But yeah. It's
this 40-year-old guy with his bug net.
On a bug net, I have to wonder if someone from high school drove by and was like, "Wait, I know that guy.
Is that Todd?
Is he okay?
He's off the deep end. He's out sweeping for butterflies."
If they knew in high school, they're like, "Oh yeah, okay."
He's in a field. He was a crop guy.
Well, not if you read the local paper. He was an astronomist.
You're an astronomist? Nice.
Yep. Yeah. He graduated with a degree in astronomy. It was probably my favorite thing ever. It's when the local paper published that.
Was that when you
graduated from
college?
Oh,
college.
Yeah. A degree in astronomy. It was like, yes. Never going to let that go.
No.
Two letters makes a big difference.
Yes.
Yes, it does.
Well, He always was staring off into space.
Yeah.
But yeah, sweeping, lots of different bugs we find there, and a lot of bugs that we don't do anything about. But I think what's interesting about sweeping alfalfa, that and something that we're going to all be doing this next week here as after first crop, is not only can you find, like, sometimes you find pests and it's like, I'm not going to do anything about it, but you also have to look at it from the perspective of the combination of pests. Like, sometimes we're not spraying for one specific pest. Sometimes we're spraying because the combination of pests that are an issue, they may not individually be a threshold, but together.
I'm not so sure that's talked about enough either.
Nor researched enough.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a...
If then.
Like an add up, like, if you're at 50% threshold of this bug and 50% threshold of this bug, you should spray, because I'm guessing that's not exactly how that works either.
Right.
But is there times where, yeah, you go like, oof, we got a lot of leafhopper and we're close to threshold, plus there's some weevil in here, like, okay, maybe, and size of the bug, especially on weevils, there's a whole bunch of little ones, and you got that whole cutting, they're going to do a lot of eating, and, you know, just kind of trying to weigh that out as well.
Yeah. Well, that's the other side of it. So it's not just how many bugs we see, but also the amount of feeding we see in regrowth. A lot of times, especially for weevil, like you mentioned, we're looking at percentage of plants that have significant weevil damage.
And that's a very tricky threshold. Let's talk about that. Is the weevil threshold is percent of stems with damage, and it's 40% of stems with any sort of feeding. So it's not 40% defoliation.
Right.
And so basically, you know, pick an area, start counting up to, say, 100 stems in each of these areas, and if you get to 40 stems out of the 100 have feeding, you're at threshold. And so that one is different, where you sweep it and you might get them in your net, but there's no threshold for sweeping and getting them in the net.
Right.
So even some of my scouts struggle with that. Sometimes they'll tell me how many they got per sweep of all the bugs. And it's like, well, no, sweep of weevil doesn't really help. You know, that's not the threshold.
And I don't think in our latitude we see a lot of first crop feeding with weevils.
No, it's, you're right. But when you were down...
Yeah, you
working
get
in like Dane County.
It wasn't every year, but every year you saw something, but every year it wasn't to threshold. And at that point, I mean, I don't ever remember spraying, you know, alfalfa is 24, 20, whatever inches tall. We got weevils. Well, we're going to cut, you know, if today's Friday and we were going to cut on Wednesday next week, well, then we're just going to cut on Monday or Sunday. You know, they just moved up the cutting, but you'd obviously have to worry about windrows and second crop. But I think that's for us, we worry more about the green up of second crop and potential taller second crop.
Well, a lot of times just how fast the stand rebounds is a good indicator of how much you need to worry. If in a drier year, if your stand's not gaining a lot of growth every week, then you're potentially going to have more of a problem. Whereas if it just shoots out of the ground, you've got adequate moisture, it's probably going to outgrow whatever. Yeah.
That's a good segue into the leafhopper threshold, which is by height. So one of the struggles I have with leafhoppers at times is, so as it gets taller, it can withstand more leafhopper pressure. So a 3-inch, you know, alfalfa is 0.2 leafhopper per sweep. And as you get to taller alfalfa, you can be half a leafhopper or a full leafhopper. Well, some of those times it does seem like Matt's teased me before, because it's like the leafhoppers are aware of the threshold and they just tell all their buddies, like, hey, come on, we're going to be in here.
Stay right.
Right.
Under.
They seem good to be half to 75% of threshold, like all the way through. And then you just get frustrated because, like, well, shoot, if I had known they would have did that, I would have sprayed them right away.
Yeah. Well, Todd's pro leafhopper.
I am.
He's working for the leafhopper cabal.
Good job, Todd.
I am not pro.
The hard part with that, Todd, is it does, like, specifically go against our principles of pest management, right? Because I know there's farms out there that the minute they see one leafhopper, they're spraying.
Right. Right. No, and that is, I mean, again, I think Matt's getting at a good point of additive thresholds. And then looking at the weather, too, like, okay, it's going to get hot and dry, and this pest seems to like that weather or not, and we'll spray according to that. The other one is, and when we talk about other pests, is all the natural enemies that are present, but leafhopper, to my knowledge, really doesn't have,
I will say, you know, to
the natural enemy that you're looking at.
To the contrary of that, like on new seedings, I feel I'm more aggressive on new seedings spraying leafhoppers if I see them, because I've been kicked in the shorts too many times of like, oh, I'll sweep them this week. Yeah, they're not that bad, but the weeds are bad, so let's get out and kill weeds. And then I go back the next week, and I'm like,
I should have thrown 6-7.
Yeah, like yeah. This like quadrupled, and now the plants are actually yellow because of it, and it's like, we should have just did it. Like,
I agree with you on the new seeds. Yeah. They seem to like that little bit lighter green color that are new seeds. They just seem to prefer them.
Yeah.
And then their damage is more extensive. And one thing with the leafhopper damage is it doesn't just hurt that cutting. I had a stand of new seeding last year. It was companion crop with oats. So it was underseeded with oats. Had new seeding underneath. And basically it was about the time where they were going to harvest the oats and the leafhopper were underneath just really bad. And we said, you know, we should really spray for the leafhopper, but it was right at the time he was going to take the oats. So the plan was take the oats, then spray the leafhopper. Well, it rained and rained and rained. Ooh. They couldn't do either. Yep. And this year now on that stand, where the oats was thick, the alfalfa looks worse and it looks spindly. And we did take a tissue sample this week to see, because it's like, well, it's potentially nutrient deficiency, but it hit me. It's probably actually leafhopper damage from last year.
Yeah.
Just hanging on yet. So
with the advent of drones, you can.
Yeah, drones.
You could do that now versus, you know,
right.
Years ago we didn't have that option.
Right. All right. So see a lot with alfalfa, but then as we were alluding to before, we started talking about black cutworm. There are other pests we have to scout for based solely on the damage in other fields. And right now, in corn is kind of a critical time for that black cutworm, because they do most of their damage when the corn is pretty small. So the disadvantage of this year is, as we were talking before we were recording, the plant isn't really shooting out of the ground. And when they're short, they're more susceptible to pests like the black cutworm. And though we haven't been finding them all across every field, Bill, you said you found a little bit of damage. I found a little bit, so it's just something we have to stay aware of. And they're a tricky one, too, because they tend to do most of their feeding at night. And so you can't just go out in the middle of the day and spray for them, because you're not going to get anything. Army worm can be that way, too, where they hang out in the shade or underground.
Or in the whirl.
In the whirl. Well, later, that's when they're easier to get to, I think, when they're in the whirl, because at least they're above ground.
Yeah.
And not hiding, but
with the cutworm though, targets you're scouting on heavily like solid bedding pack manure fields, rye cover, you know, any type of cover crop, any type of no-till into alfalfa, anything
that was green
grassy,
yeah.
Weed,
yep. Weed, yeah,
weed, yep. Just anything that where the moths would have been attracted to, laid their eggs, and now what they laid their eggs in is potentially gone or leaving, and now all they have to eat is our corn.
Yeah, and they are fairly distinctive in how they feed. Like armyworm chews on the plant too, but it's more of a jagged feeding. These guys are like a buzzsaw. They just kind of cut it right off like it was a tree. They'll just go right at the base and knock it over.
They seem to know right where the growing point is and just cut right, you know, basically at or below that point, killing the plant. I mean, it rarely is it where they're above that.
Do you think they say timber when?
Yes, I would like to think
they
do.
They cut them and they say timber.
To me, they're dicks in that they don't eat the rest of the stem.
Right.
They just keep going down the road.
Right, they just chew off that part. And then
right,
the next,
it's yeah. Like, you know, and they'll eat 4 to 5 a day, I believe, is kind of, you know, depending on the life size and all that. But, yeah, it's just like, well, yeah, just feed on the one plant, we'd be fine. But they just cut one, keep going down the road, cut another.
They're like sandhill cranes. They're dicks. Because sandhill cranes pull the whole plant out, the kernel at the bottom.
I did read an article in the State Farmer that they're talking about adding a season again.
Yeah, I had a farmer that had to go talk in Madison in front of the legislature about that. And I know one of the things that was holding them back was the fact that their path to us, there's several states that have seasons before they get here.
Oh.
When they migrate. So that's, I guess, one of the hang-ups is they're worried about them getting over-hunted because they can be hunted in a number of places. But I don't know. There still seems to be plenty of them out there. So that's a pest we don't want to get in the sweep net either.
No.
That would be an interesting time. But yeah, so cutworm, tube management with them is you'd want to spray it at dawn or dusk or at night because that's when they're more active. And yeah, you guys were saying, so we've got some traps out. There's a network of monitoring for that and those moth counts were going down, you said, right?
Lately? Yeah, if you, the DadCap has a pest survey. If you Google just DadCap pest survey, you can get to it. And the pest monitoring networks we're involved with, and I think we may have talked about this already, but right now we're doing black cutworm and true armyworm. And the hard part with the moth traps is it's not like a direct correlation of this many moths in the trap equals this pressure in the field. Like it's just to give you an idea of our populations rising or are they falling? And the neat part is the black cutworm in a couple of weeks will turn into a western bean cutworm trap. And that directly correlated last year of not the pressure in the field, but when the moth traps went up, the more, and it was just exactly that, the more there were more moths, so there were more moths laying eggs in the field.
Yep.
So that was neat. You could tell exactly when to be out scouting because
the rise of
the trap. Sure. Not the specific number, but just that the number was rising. So you can actually look and you can, there's a boatload of traps out there. I don't know, over 100 and maybe 50. I don't know, but you can go by county and see the counts by week. So last week in Brown, it was at 16. Just for argument, just for perspective, it was 46 the week before, and 3 weeks before that was 71. So the last month we slowly declined. Yeah, sure. And we talked that before we off air here, but I think some of last week was just it was dang cold, and were the moths even moving?
Right. So yeah, that's an idea of kind of what we're looking at the field right now. There'll be other pests like the western bean that we look for later, but it's a season long thing, and we're just kind of getting to the start of that season right now. And so far, you know, we haven't seen big numbers, but we'll be keeping an eye on things as we go. So now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So I think all three of us were 4-H'ers. Our kids, at least Todd and my kids are in 4-H. So we've all kind of been around it. And Indiana right now is seeing some program growth with their 4-H. So record project numbers this year, which is kind of cool to see. So their program is continuing to grow. They set the record this past year with 155,000 projects exhibited. And while kids go through many different, you know, phases, different jobs that they're looking to go to throughout the year, everyone who participated in their 4-H program has the skills necessary to be successful, according to Tony Carell, the program director. So 4-H program is now different than it was before, continually stay focused on what are the needs and what we believe the future needs are going to be of for young people so we can keep them prepared. And it is, 4-H has a lot of different types of programs. It's not just animals. You've got arts and crafts, woodworking, electricity, rockets. So there's a lot of different options for kids. And it's good to see that the program is growing there. I know it seems to ebb and flow. I mean, when I was younger and in 4-H, our club was like the smallest in the county. I think Todd, yours was one of the bigger ones, and then they kind of flip-flopped as we got older.
That does. It's crazy how that happens.
It's funny how that, yeah. But, yeah. So it's cool to see that at least in some parts of the country, there's still some growth in that program, and hopefully will continue into the future. So now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So since we were talking about pests, thought it'd be good to talk a little bit about the history of integrated pest management, specifically economic thresholds. So what is an economic threshold? Well, in 1959, entomologists came up with definitions for the concepts that have been used for pest control for many years. They defined economic damage as the amount of injury which will justify the cost of artificial control measures. The economic injury level as the lowest population density that will cause economic damage, and the economic threshold is the density at which control measures should be initiated or used to prevent the increase in population. Unique combination of pest biology and economics theoretically gave growers the tool to use at a time when pesticide applications were going to produce the greatest possible profits. Until the advent of the economic threshold, sprays were applied in a preventative manner, usually on a calendar basis, which, as we've seen over the years, that would be, you know, somewhat effective, but ultimately not as effective, since you might spray and then 2 weeks later see the actual, you know, giant push from insects and kind of waste the spray there. So rather than calendar-based, this is more based on those levels and populations. And though we have them for a lot of serious pests in agriculture, we don't have them for every pest. So economic thresholds are notoriously difficult to determine. And at first glance, it would appear to be pretty straightforward cost-benefit relationship involving controlling costs and market values, but if you consider the influence of multiple pests on a crop, injury per individual pests, crop response to injury at various stages of development, climate conditions, nutritional stress, varietal differences, and the purpose for which the crop is grown and fluctuating market values, then you can see how that can be kind of really hard to pin down for some things. So, yeah.
All right, thank you, Matt, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. That's all we ask for. Tell somebody out there while they're cutting hay now or chopping, hey, did you listen to the latest episode of Tilth Talk Radio? It's very easy. All they need to do is search Tilth Talk Radio and Apple Podcasts on their iPhone or on an Android phone. Download an app like Podcast Addict. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts, and you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right, thanks, Todd. Now we'll get into our Cool Beans, That's Corny, and some current events. So, Cool Beans?
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week, JBS is looking to build a sausage-making facility in Perry, Iowa. So JBS has announced plans to build a $135 million sausage production facility that will create more than 700 jobs in Perry, Iowa. Cameron Brewitt, the head of corporate affairs for the company, said the facility will be state-of-the-art and that there's going to be nothing like it anywhere in the rest of the country. It's probably the first facility of its kind built in the last 40 years. And that's exciting for us to be a new entrant, new competitor in a growing space in agriculture, he said. So it's kind of good to see improvement on that side of agriculture as opposed to closing down of facilities and layoffs. So good to see that they are looking to increase jobs and increase the effort of producing quality food. So,
do you think we'll find out how the sausage is made?
I don't know if we want to know. It's always the double-edged sword of, yeah, want to know what's in it, but sometimes you don't.
Just tastes good. And some people in Perry, Iowa are going to find out.
Yeah, they will find out how the sausage is made. All right. Our That's Corny this week. Crop protection tools got attention in the Make America Healthy Again report, and not in a good way. So the new report from the Make America Healthy Again Commission is causing some ruffles here in the ag industry. 68-page report featured studies showing possible health risks from glyphosate and atrazine, and bias in company-funded studies on product safety. So it feels like we keep going back and forth with a lot of these things, especially glyphosate. And, you know, that's right here, the Darren Kopic with the Ag Retailers Association said that there are two pesticides that have been studied more than glyphosate and atrazine. I don't know what they are. Been looked at up, down, and sideways, not only by EPA, but regulators around the world. And if everybody around the world comes out and says glyphosate is a carcinogen, it's probably not a carcinogen. But the report seems to not look at all that has been done by the EPA in some of these studies to ensure products are safe. And the immediate threat is the loss of crop protection tools. And I know we talked about, you know, Bayer considering stopping production on Roundup. So it's just, yeah, it's unfortunate that we have to keep going round and round the same circle over and over again. So we'll see what comes of it. But as of right now, I'm sure it'll be continue to stay under the microscope, and we'll see if anything really comes of it. I know they've initially said that there's no immediate plans for any changes, but we'll see what happens down the road. So now to wrap things up with the Field Good Friday. If you're a NASCAR fan, you might know that Ross Chastain won the Coca-Cola 600, which I believe was in Nashville, if all the commercials I saw with Dale Earnhardt Jr. were correct. And so NASCAR driver Ross Chastain added a big win to his resume this past weekend. It's the sixth win of his career. But what most people don't know is Chastain is an eighth-generation watermelon farmer from southern Florida who's now on a mission to share ag story on a national stage. So I didn't watch the race, but apparently he smashed a watermelon after he won, and it came from his
farm.
That's
the coolest celebration.
Yeah. There's the one where they drink milk. There's usually champagne. And
isn't the Indy 500 where they drink milk?
I think so.
This is like Gallagher style is up there.
Yeah, I don't think he used a hammer. I think he just threw it against the ground. But yeah, he got to smash watermelon in Victory Lane, which is a tradition he started to toast his farming ties. Chastain, who's known as the Watermelon Man, apparently, because of his family's background in farming. So said this watermelon he smashed was fresh from Florida. It came up from the family farm. So as a kid, all he wanted to do was farm behind the wheel of the Chevrolet ZL1 race car is where he finds himself now. But he grew up on a farm in southern Florida, and he wanted to become a farmer, wanted to be like his dad and his granddad and his uncle, and who talked about ancestors and generations before growing up in South Georgia, farming in hard times and good times. His father is a seventh-generation watermelon farmer, but he also raced as a hobby. Chastain and his brother Chad are eighth generation. Their family got started in South Georgia before moving to southern Florida in the 1950s. It's a place his brother and the rest of his family still farm today. So even though he started NASCAR as what he thought would be a hobby and while he was going to school, he eventually turned it into a career, but he still has ties back to his family farm. So it's kind of cool. All sorts of different kind of farmers and stuff in life. We've had Olympians. We've had NASCAR drivers, football players. So ag is everywhere. So next time you see him race, I guess have some watermelon.
I'm trying to he like really chucks it down. Like he holds it up.
Oh, did you see a video of it?
Oh yeah, there's
like a medicine ball.
And then just smashes it down. Yeah. And I'm trying to think if you'd more yeet it like a shot putter.
Yeah.
Or do that. Cause now too, like he's on top of the car, so he's gotta get like down in all the watermelon mess. So just so you don't like slip or whatever. It's insane. Yeah.
I feel like if you were gonna yeet it, you'd wanna like get some rotation going and just kinda like give it a big chuck.
Yep.
But some of those watermelons are tough. I mean,
Right. That's what I mean. You wouldn't want to throw it and then it just bounce and not totally break.
Smash a car window if you weren't careful which direction you threw it in. All right. Well, that'll do it for today. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So today we talked about some of the pests we're starting to see out in the field and the monitoring we'll be doing moving into the season. In our spotlight, we talked about growth in the 4-H program, in this case in Indiana, but hopefully that will carry out into other states as well. Ag History Minute, we talked about the history of economic thresholds. Cool beans this week, JBS building a new sausage facility in Perry, Iowa, creating 700 jobs. That's corny. Glyphosate and atrazine back in the spotlight because of the Make America Healthy Again report. And our Feel Good Friday was Ross Chastain, not just a NASCAR driver, but also watermelon farmer. Thanks for listening. As always, happy farming.